think I see it going right across my deck here now. I did not
All right, so this is just Roger. Thanks for that information, sir, and I'll get back to you if we come up with anything. Over.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Beyond the Breakers, a podcast about shipwrecks, loss, and lessons learned from maritime disasters. My name's Tanner, and I'll be one of your hosts today. Before I bring in Taylor, we do have a new patron to thank. I want to give a huge shout out to Baptiste, and also want to say thank you for the lovely message that you sent us on Twitter. That's always great to read. We love to know who's listening to the show, why people listen to the show, what people get out of the show,
what they're doing when they listen to the show.
We love all of that. So thank you for supporting the show and for writing us that message. And here's Taylor. You've already heard his voice a little bit here, so we might as well bring him in officially. How's it going?
It's pretty good. Getting back into the swing of things after all of our adventures we've had in the last few weeks. It's been kind of nice in a way. Then you get back in your routine and everything. As far as media stuff, continuing to work through Blood and Thunder by Hampton Sides. And I don't know, I've actually really enjoyed it. I like want to go out to Denver and just work my way south down towards like Albuquerque now and just explore this area. It's not an area I've ever been to.
And reenact the actions of Kit Carson.
It is interesting kind of hearing that he's like the kindest, gentlest version of this type of person.
Mm-hmm.
He's as good as it gets, essentially. So it is very interesting that like he still does horrible things, but also like how much more interconnected he is with the Native Americans that are living there versus if you're just a federal soldier that signed up from Ohio. He did have to live with these people and stuff. So it is very interesting kind of learning more about that. And the book does a good job of not really taking sides and stuff, but just kind of presenting the world as it existed at the time. One of Kit Carson's wives was a Native woman, maybe two of them. And not that that necessarily means anything, but it, you know, by all accounts, he, you know, was good to them and like, had children with them who were very much were his children to him. So mm-hmm. It's interesting seeing kind of the nuance that these are all still people at the time. Like, yeah, they're capable of horrible, awful things, but also capable of trying to make things as good as they can be. And it's interesting seeing that spectrum and knowing that at the end of the day, really all of it's being done in the service of bad things. Other than that, I've been working on doing some of those bad things myself via Civilization 5 and 6. You know how those games are. You start playing it, and before you know it, it's like 3 hours later.
Yeah, those turn-based games are addictive.
But I've just kind of gotten back into those. I saw that Civ 6 was free on the PlayStation Store, and I had never played it on console, but I downloaded it and kind of got me re-hooked. And I've been playing Civ 5 and Civ 6 on the PC now. So I actually like Civ 5 better than Civ 6.
I think I've liked each Civilization less as they make more of them.
Civ 5 is the perfect balance of, hey, this game is complex and deep, versus it's still easy to play without having to write stuff down and basically do logistics. What about you?
The most interesting thing I've read recently was a book called The Others of Edenwell by Verity Holloway.
Mm-hmm.
And how I found this book was from the Terror Camp conference a few weeks ago. She gave a presentation that was really great. And as I was watching all these great presentations, I did a lot of shopping online for books. And that was one of the ones I grabbed. I love books that are set during World War One, but in other locations than just the Western Front in Europe.
Yeah, that is an interesting time.
Particularly ones that are set in...
Mm-hmm.
In one of my college classes, we read Regeneration by Pat Barker, and that's set, you know, in a mental hospital during World War One. It's about Siegfried Sassoon and Wilfred Owen.
Mm-hmm.
And this one's really great. It's about a hospital in Norfolk in England in 1917 called Edenwell Hydropathic, a wellness retreat. And it's kind of a slow build. And there's some parts in it that are like, you know, truly eerie, truly creepy. It's really just a good book. The way that she writes the relationships between the two main characters, just excellent overall.
Yeah, I'll have to jot that one down.
Also been listening to Cargo Cult podcast. It's another tech podcast I can throw into the mix with Trash Future and This Machine Kills. I like Cargo Cult because they talk about tech stuff that's in the news kind of in the same way that I'm capable of understanding it and talking about it. I love Trash Future, but I don't understand half the stuff they're talking about because it's it's British stuff.
Right.
And then also so much of that I listen to just because they're all really funny. And then TMK I listen to when I'm feeling a bit more serious because they tend to cover topics that are pretty deep. And I don't understand like 70% of what I listen to on This Machine Kills. But that's what I want to listen to when I want to feel like I'm learning, but it also makes me feel very dumb because I don't know what they're talking about half the time. Cargo Cult, I think, is a wonderful balance of all those things. It's very funny. It's very informative, and I can understand it.
That's a nice balance. I have not listened to that one, but I definitely want to. It's one of those that I'm always sitting around being like, I need a new podcast to listen to at work, and then I can't think of any, so that's one I'll have to...
I haven't listened to their newest one. They were kind of on a hiatus for a bit, so I'm still catching up. I still have a few more to go. Well, let's do this. I started writing this episode like before we went on our road trip, so getting recombobulated, trying to remember all the stuff I wrote here and make sure it's all put together right.
I'm seeing a lot of Russian words. I can't wait to ask for help with pronunciation.
As I mentioned, I think at the end of our last episode, today's story, we are going back to the Soviet Union / Russia, somewhere we've been several times over the past few seasons. We talked about the Rusalka, that monitor from the kind of late Russian Empire. Mm-hmm. We talked about the Admiral Nakhimov. That's the one that I did with Jamie from Old Shipping Lines. We talked about the submarine Kursk. That's one that you researched and presented. And we talked about the Dalny Vostok, that fishing vessel that sank in the Sea of Okhotsk. So we're back again to our rich mine of maritime disasters that Russia is. And as with the Admiral Nakhimov, we're going back to the Soviet Union of the 1980s.
Just a time that was ripe for Soviet shipwrecks.
And as with the Admiral Nakhimov, the ship that we talk about today has been referred to as the Soviet Titanic.
Everything is the something Titanic.
Some countries have two Titanics. Also, the source material for this episode, all of the sources I use were in Russian. There's very little written about this incident in English. There's really not a lot written about it in Russian. The last couple years, there's been more writing about it. I'll get more into what those sources were. But everything that I grabbed was in Russian, so that means all of the quotes you hear are originally in Russian, translated by me. So if stuff doesn't make sense, if stuff doesn't sound smooth, I guarantee it sounded better in Russian.
That, I just want to say that's really cool that there isn't a lot of English language media about this, and you're kind of able to make some. So that is not something I thought about when we first started talking about let's have a shipwreck podcast, but that's really cool.
This is the work we do for free most of the time. So the year is 1983. In the realm of foreign policy, the USSR is a little over 3 years into its military adventure in Afghanistan.
This is when we fade in the blowback intro music.
I'm so excited for new blowback. So Leonid Brezhnev had died in November 1982, the role of general secretary being taken up by the 68-year-old former KGB head Yuri Andropov. Our story is going to take us to the city of Ulyanovsk on the Volga. Ulyanovsk, which was named Simbirsk in pre-Soviet times, it's a little over 400-ish miles east of Moscow, south of Kazan, if that helps you.
I'm actually pulling it up on a map right now.
If you look at a map of like this portion of Russia between Moscow and where the Volga is, you kind of see all of the big heavy-hitting historical names from Russian history. You see a ton of these old, old cities with so much history. And the trip we're going to talk about here is actually one I would love to go on someday.
But not right now.
Probably not right now. So just a little bit about Ulyanovsk, because that's where the story's going to happen. Like many other Russian cities, it had been renamed after the formation of the Soviet Union. and as the birthplace of Vladimir Ilyich Ulyanov, better known as Vladimir Lenin, it was renamed Ulyanovsk in his honor in 1924.
You know, I was going to ask you why the name change, but now I understand why the name change.
You see a lot of them happen in 1924. There's a huge campaign of renaming things and sort of de-czarifying things, kind of removing it from Russia's imperial past.
The thing they kind of try to lean into now in a weird way.
Yeah, it's an interesting mix of stuff that they have going on there now.
It is a weird mix of taking like the best of each thing.
Kind of the pride in the Russian Empire, pride in, you know, the successes of the Red Army in World War II. There's a lot there to sort of sift through. But I think I was thinking about this the other day and how there's a certain sort of like Russian nationalism where you get that. And I was thinking, like, trying not to orientalize Russia too much. And I was thinking Americans do the same thing. You'd see plenty of people who would proudly wear an American flag and a Confederate one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's probably just as confusing. Suffice it to say, the Russian Federation has daddy issues.
Don't we all? Other examples of this renaming, some of the famous examples, very famously, St. Petersburg. It actually changed its name to Petrograd in 1914, which I think was just a de-Germanification choice to make it sound less German. That was in 1914, obviously before the revolution. And then after the creation of the Soviet Union, that becomes Leningrad. It'd
be so annoying to like live there and deal with that.
Yekaterinburg, famously the final residence of the Romanovs, that became the city of Sverdlovsk. Tsaritsyn on the Volga became famously Stalingrad and is now called Volgograd. We'll talk a little bit about it in a few minutes. And one for the maritime fans, the city of Alexandrovsk in the far north became Polyarny, which is where the nuclear submarine base is, where I believe the Red October leaves from in the
Hunt,
aptly named Hunt for Red October. Polyarny just means like polar. Not a super inventive name. There's actually another round of renaming that happens after the territorial acquisitions in World War II. All of that land that is taken that had previously been occupied by Germany.
Mm-hmm.
One of which is the historical Prussian city of Königsberg, which becomes Kaliningrad, which is that weird little piece of Russia that isn't attached to the rest of Russia.
That if Putin keeps messing around, one day will be part of Germany or Poland again.
Ulyanovsk had a population of about 528,000 in 1983. Today, that's around 620,000, which puts it in the ballpark of other Russian cities like Irkutsk and Vladivostok. So it's kind of around the 25th largest city in Russia. Also a little bit larger than Milwaukee.
I always like doing that when you're looking at another country, is finding somewhere that's like comparable to something you know here and just seeing like, what is the Dayton, Ohio of Iran?
So in Russia, obviously, you've got Moscow and St. Petersburg,
mm-hmm.
and then kind of a big drop off. Do you know what the third most populated city in Russia is?
Is it like Vladivostok or something random?
No, but you're kind of thinking the right way. It's not something I would have. It would not have been my guess. It's Novosibirsk.
I wouldn't have gotten that.
I would have guessed maybe Rostov or something. But yeah, Novosibirsk.
I think of Vladivostok as like the Seattle of Russia. Just a bunch of pot smoking hippies.
And a lot of fishermen, I think.
Yeah, I think
both cities. So let's meet our main character. This is the river cruise ship Alexander Suvorov, which, despite our story happening in 1983, is still in service. So I might drift between past and present in describing her. The Suvorov was/is about 450 feet in length and 55 feet in beam, with about a 9.5-foot draft. A member of the Valerian Koibyshev class, she was completed in 1981, constructed by Slovenskaya Lodnitsa in Komarno in modern-day southwestern Slovakia. I don't know how to pronounce Slovakian words. She and her 8 sister ships in the Valerian Koibyshev class are some of the largest river cruise ships in the world.
I mean, you can really only make one so big.
Yeah, kind of a limiting factor, I guess, that they're river cruisers. Her sisters included, you might recognize some of these names, the Felix Dzerzhinsky, the Mikhail Frunze, Semyon Budyonny, Georgi Zhukov, and Mikhail Kalinin, which is now the Mstislav Rostropovich. The Suvorov is unique among her sisters in that she was named not for a Soviet-era figure, which I thought was interesting. Mm-hmm. All of these are Soviet names. You've got Dzerzhinsky, Frunze, who's really influential in the early Red Army, Semyon Budyonny, famous for his accomplishments during the Russian Civil War, and he was kind of one of those doddering old generals when World War II broke out.
Mm-hmm.
He was not a big believer in the tank. He kind of thought that the tank was a passing fad and that his cavalry would be more valuable in the long run.
Uh-huh.
He eventually got promoted upwards so that he could no longer
get in
mess
the way.
Anything up. Yeah, exactly. And then, of course, Zhukov, everyone knows, from the death of Stalin.
Yes.
She isn't named for one of these Soviet-era figures. She's named for Alexander Suvorov, the late 18th century, maybe technically very early 19th century. He died in 1800. He served from the Seven Years' War all the way until the Napoleonic era.
Was he just deemed as like a safe option?
He's kind of such a big name, like not just in Russia, but like in military history. You know, this general who, you know, fought for what, like five decades and never lost a battle that he was commanding. So it's kind of like he's such a big deal in history that it doesn't matter if he's from the imperial era, we'll use his name.
She kind of transcends it.
I think the Russian Military Academy, or one of them, is named after Alexander Suvorov.
I mean, I, again, would say that's weird, but what, up until a year ago, we had like Fort Bragg, and he wasn't even a good general.
This is true. Yeah, I mean,
objectively, he wasn't even good at what he was supposed to do.
No one liked him and he wasn't good. Why did we name this after him?
Yeah, at least pick one that was good at their job.
Well, in that case, you could legitimately have like a Fort Forrest or something.
That's true. We don't want that either.
Don't want to open up that. So these cruise ships are used for leisure trips on the Volga and its connected river systems. One of the articles I'm going to be quoting from is called Deadly Cruise, The Wreck of the Soviet Titanic, by Yakov Lysenko. He writes,
although the Suvorov was not considered the most luxurious Soviet liner, in contrast to the Anton Chekhov and the Lev Tolstoy, there was no pool. The level of comfort was still high. Each cabin had its own bathroom, and on board there were two restaurants, a bar, reading, and music rooms. On the sun deck, located above, you could visit the solarium, attend a movie screening, and enjoy yourself on the dance floor.
Price, from what I could see, starting at about 450 rubles, which, I mean, today, that's like nothing. I think today, 450 rubles.
I'm about to Google search it, but it's going to like put me on a list.
Today, 450 rubles is about $5. So don't think about modern rubles to dollars.
That could probably buy you a couple gallons of Russian oil.
450 rubles at the time was a pretty significant amount of money. That would have been roughly equivalent to a few months' pay. You kind of can't think of it in exchange terms because like that was never happening here.
Mm-hmm.
That's a pretty significant amount of money. However, by and large, a lot of these passengers were not paying for these things out of pocket. This was the kind of thing that, you know, the vouchers for these cruises are mostly or entirely paid for by the trade workers' unions. So maybe they would pay for, you know, a group, you know, vacation or something, a cruise on the Volga for, you know, this whole, I don't know, department or whole factory, whatever it may be.
When the whole tractor factory gets to go on the cruise, right?
On this particular cruise, most of those aboard were workers in the coal industry, along with their families.
I've seen Chernobyl, so I know what we're dealing with here.
A lot of these come from the Donbas region of Ukraine.
Oh, I know that place.
And the next door Russian region of Rostov Oblast.
The part that actually belongs to Russia.
That whole area is a big coal mining area.
Natural resources, you say?
So that's where the bulk of the coal mining is done in the area. And actually, this does connect to the war in Ukraine. because even like back in 2014, when you had these new republics being declared in this area, that actually led to Ukraine being cut off from like 90% of their coal reserves.
Interesting.
And it's also worth noting that nowhere is coal mining really a safe job.
Mm-hmm.
You've got the long-term effects, of course, the damage it does to your lungs, to your body, but also the short-term dangers of mine cave-ins, explosions, all of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's never safe, but it's particularly dangerous here in Donbass due to the depths that it happens at.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so these are like exceptionally deep mines.
They're very, very deep mines. Here, anthracite and bituminous coal are extracted from the depths approaching 6,000 feet, more than a mile underground. Pretty deep. I don't know how Russian/Ukrainian safety regulations are for mines.
I can only imagine at this point in the Soviet Union, lax.
Probably not great. And in addition to those from the coal mining region, there's passengers from the western Ukrainian city of Lvov, or Lviv, if you want to be Ukrainian about it. All of my sources were in Russian, so Lvov, as well as from the Transcaucasus. Yes, they made the Caucasus trans. So this is the South Caucasus. So this is Georgia, Armenia, Azerbaijan, the parts of the Caucasus that are not in Russia today.
One thing I'm wondering, I don't know this about the Soviet Union. Does everyone speak Russian, or are we going to have issues with communication at some point in this story?
No, I mean, that's the language of communication here.
Okay.
I mean, even in Ukraine would probably be a bit of a question. I mean, Eastern Ukraine, as we've seen with the war in Ukraine, a lot of Eastern Ukrainians do speak Russian at home. They would identify as Russian.
Mm-hmm.
Someone from Western Ukraine probably speaks Russian, especially at this point. Maybe they speak with an accent.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, what is Ukrainian but Russian with a weird accent? So yeah, I mean, that would be the language of communication. I don't think there would be any issues with confusion or communication here.
Just have to keep the Armenians and the Azerbaijanis separate.
Got to keep them separated.
Yes.
As the Offspring once said.
That's actually what that song's about.
So we're at the incident now. The Alexander Suvorov was several days into a trip from Rostov-on-Don, which is on the Sea of Azov, to Moscow.
It's funny that I know where all these places are now.
Yeah, thanks to all of the news over the last...
Thanks, Putin.
What, 2 years now?
Yeah, it's been a long time. So just looking at it on the map, like that would be a really cool cruise, though.
It looks so cool. I would love to go on this trip. This route would take the ship up the Don River from Rostov. That's why it's called Rostov on Don.
Is that why the Donbass is called the Donbass?
Yes, that's part of it. To the Vladimir Ilyich Lenin Volga Don Shipping Canal, which in Russian they just call the VDSK. VDSK, I guess they would call it.
That sounds like a Russian organization that kills people.
The Volga Donskoy Sudohodny Canal. This was opened in 1953 to allow transit between two of Russia's major river systems. You could connect the Don to the Volga, and you are just in business there. The canal puts ships out on the Volga just below the city of Volgograd, which used to be Stalingrad. Continuing up the river, you get to the city of Saratov, which is a city with huge historical, cultural significance. They've got one of the oldest theaters in Russia, dating back to 1802. Saratov was also a closed city during the Soviet era, which is a fascinating part of the Soviet Union, making it basically just off limits to foreigners.
Interesting. I'm looking at it on the map, or on Google Maps here, and it looks like a really interesting place.
Yeah, there's so many places over there I would like to visit. Someday. So for our incident, the date is June 5th, 1983. The time is about 10:40 p.m. local time. The Alexander Suvorov is approaching Ulyanovsk, having traveled very roughly about 800 miles from Rostov on the rivers. I just did that by the click and measure thing on Google Maps, so it's probably a very rough estimate. At dinner time that evening, an announcement was made congratulating the head chef on board the Suvorov on her birthday. All of your standard birthday celebrations were underway.
Nice. Sounds like a festive time. Nothing bad can happen.
It was a warm evening with plenty of passengers enjoying the night air out on deck. On the top deck of the vessel, passengers are having fun on the dance floor, or attending a film screening in the movie theater. Yakov Lysenko writes that the film being shown was a film called Pochishenie Svyatego Luki, which is The Kidnapping of St. Luke.
Interesting.
And I couldn't find that this movie exists anywhere. There is a movie called Возвращение Святого Луки, which is The Return of St. Luke. And it's about the theft of Franz Hall's painting of St. Luke from his series of the four evangelists.
So that definitely sounds like it could fit then, huh?
I don't want to assume it's a mistake, but it could be.
Could there just be some weird translating issues going on there?
The words are very similar. They have the same ending in Russian. So, like, maybe it's a mix-up. I could not find any movie called The Kidnapping of St. Luke. But that movie that I found, I think it came out in 1971. So, like, it would have existed at the time. Maybe it's a related film. But they're watching a movie. Also, confusing thing about this, a lot of these sources I was reading, you know, they come from newspapers, news organizations. And, you know, they cover the story in very similar ways, but sometimes there's details that are changed from one to the other. And I don't have a definitive answer of which one's accurate. Most of the writing refers to this movie area as the Kinozal. That's just a word for a movie theater. Yekaterina Nikolaeva, writing in the Russian language version of Tech Insider, she refers to it as an improvizirovani kinoteatr. A makeshift theater. I don't know if this was an actual movie theater or just a room that could be used to show movies. I don't know that it makes a huge difference in the story, but regardless of which film it was or what kind of room they're in, you've got a lot of passengers watching it. And I cannot stress this enough, watching this on the Suvorov's top deck. That is important.
Oh no. I mean, judging by the location, that would have to be improvised.
Maybe it's like a big projector screen on something. So in total, there's likely around probably more than 200 people on the upper deck of the Suvorov.
That seems like that might change the weight distribution, like profile of the vessel, potentially.
It might. That's not going to matter, though.
Oh. So we're not talking Eastland.
No. In command on the bridge of the Suvorov was First Officer Yevgeny Matenkov, along with helmsman Andrei Uvarov, who is referred to in some sources as inexperienced. The captain, 52-year-old Vladimir Klemenov, with 26 years of experience, was, say the line, off duty at the time and asleep in his cabin. One source said that he was off duty and asleep in his cabin. I believe another source said that he was up and about, but he wasn't on duty.
Did anyone say he was drunk? I feel like they always say they're drunk.
That does come up later.
And being in Russia, like, there is a shot, I guess.
But it's not necessarily him.
Okay.
He was preparing to take the watch later that night. And again, nothing good seems to happen in these stories when the captain's off duty.
No.
There's a kind of weird part in that Nikolaeva piece, and that's why I'm kind of reluctant to lean towards the improvised theater thing. Mm-hmm. There's a weird part there where she writes that Matenkov was reading a book in the wheelhouse and Uvarov was steering the Colossus. Mm-hmm. And something's about to happen where I don't know how we would know that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how we would know what the first officer was doing. And we're going to find out why. The Suvorov's route up the Volga toward Ulyanovsk will bring her under the Imperial Bridge, the Imperatorsky Most.
Mm-hmm.
This is a more than 2,000 meter long bridge that has both rail and road sections. The rail section is on the south side, so closer to where the Suvorov would be coming from. I'm telling you which side of the bridge is where for a reason. With the way that the Imperial Bridge, and probably really every bridge over water, I'm guessing.
Right.
The way it's designed, not every span of the bridge would allow a vessel like the Suvorov to travel under it.
Yeah, I would imagine you would assume that the vessel would stay in the main channel.
The normal transit of the bridge would have taken the Suvorov under the bridge's third span. I don't honestly know which side of the river that's counting from.
I'm actually on Google Maps looking at it now. And I don't even know. It could be a different bridge by now, too, as far as like the pilings and things.
There are two bridges now in Ulyanovsk. There's the Imperial Bridge, and then further north, there's the...
The Presidentsky Bridge?
Yeah, the Presidential Bridge. Also, Presidentsky sounds like someone making fun of how Russians would probably say the word president.
I know. I loved it. I had to say it as soon as I saw it.
So that's the normal way to get under the bridge. And this is a route that this ship would have taken many, many, many times before. This is the normal route that she runs.
I feel like if you're part of the crew of any sort of river vessel, going under a bridge is kind of a basic function.
Got to know how to do it.
That's important on a river.
Could I take a ship under a bridge? No. These guys probably should be able to. According to the Lysenko article, at 10:45, passengers in their cabins noticed a dull humming and grinding sound.
Oh no.
The Suvorov had struck the Imperial Bridge at a speed of about 25 kilometers an hour, or about 15 miles per hour, which is top speed for this vessel.
All of the sun deck, together with the deckhouse, movie theater, dance floor, and smokestacks, were sheared off, as if by a guillotine. From the force of the impact, a 1,500-ton segment of the bridge was shifted 40 centimeters.
40 centimeters being about 15 inches.
That's over a foot.
Yes, it moves this a lot.
That's insane. This thing ghost shipped.
It did. That was exactly what I thought about when I first saw this. Valery Beskrovny, a survivor who'd been on the Suvorov with his wife Lyubov, remembered those moments this way.
At first, everything jerked and flickered, a short circuit. And then, the end of the world. The deckhouse, the movie theater, in which there were 250 people, everything became mixed up, and everything was rushing towards the people.
But as so often happens on this show, it does get worse. Truly, I think if you put this part in the movie, people would be upset and they'd say there's no way this happened.
I'm reading ahead and I'm upset. This is sloppy, poor writing.
The writer's room for 1980s Soviet Union needs to get canned.
Yeah.
Oleg Shishkin, reporting for Pervy Kanal, writes,
"At this time, a freight train was crossing the bridge. Train cars tipped over, dumping logs, grain, and coal. It was said that in the place of the freight train, there should have been a passenger train, but it had been late, and the dispatcher sent the freight train ahead at the last moment."
So I guess not as worse as it could have gotten.
I feel like the original thing was, yeah, passenger train, and then they're like, guys, we can't do that. Like, make it a freight train. If Mark Wahlberg had been the engineer on that freight train, it wouldn't have gone down that way.
So in Lysenko's article, and he's writing for Gazeta, which is just one of the big news media companies for Russia. The train is described as being 3,300 tons, made up of 53 cars, and traveling at 70 kilometers an hour, about 43 miles per hour.
It's so funny that I have no idea how fast 70 kilometers per hour is. None. Couldn't tell you if that's really fast or just kind of...
This is just insane timing. And I guess, like, granted, yes, like a 53 car train is pretty long. The timing wouldn't have to be like perfect, but still, that's insane.
It is really insane.
11 of these cars fell from the tracks and into the Volga / onto the Alexander Suvorov. Lysenko also writes,
"It was only by a miracle that a tanker car full of fuel became stuck in the trusses of the bridge and did not fall onto the ship."
Presumably, if that had done that, I'm guessing it could have caught on fire.
I mean, it wouldn't be great.
And here's something else. Another just very faint, almost microscopic silver lining we can draw from this incident was the way that the Suvorov was constructed.
An additional factor that saved many lives was the block construction of the fourth deck. If it had been welded, the ship would have crumpled like an accordion.
And I don't know this, and maybe someone listening who knows more about Soviet era ship construction can explain. In the source, and I cut it out here for the reading, it says if it had been welded like the rest, the ship would have crumpled like an accordion. And I assume it means like the rest of the ships in the fleet. I don't know exactly what that meant. So I don't know if the Suvorov was unique in how its top deck was constructed.
Oh, yeah, I see what you're saying.
But it seems like it was good that it was just built that way. Or at least better. Still not good, because the whole top gets sheared off. But I guess it's a bit like collapse zones in a car.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want the whole ship to absorb the shock of this bridge. So getting into the aftermath here, the hospitals in Ulyanovsk were crowded with dead and injured, the majority suffering lacerations, but with many having limbs fully severed. There's pretty horrifying stuff, types of injuries here.
Yeah, I imagine that is not good.
Now, one part of this story I don't quite fully understand, and I'd like to actually expand some of this out into a bonus episode where we can look at this further, is Captain Klemenov. So he was, you know, at least according to some sources, asleep in his cabin when this happened, when the collision happened. He was thrown into the water at some point and found alive, actually, near one of the bridge supports. He was picked up.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not exactly sure how he would have been ejected during the collision if he was in his cabin.
Yeah, that is interesting.
I don't know the physics behind that. Maybe he got up like right at the initial part of it. He knew something was wrong and, you know, he went outside and was thrown overboard. But regardless, Klemenov survives. And all that being said, the official death toll of the incident is 176. A lot of the current writing on this seems to be in agreement that the official death toll might not be totally realistic.
It was unofficially reported that the number of deaths could be as high as 300. The ship was overloaded. On board were not only the 330 declared passengers, but also 50 crew members, 35 service staff, and also friends and relatives of the crew.
And yeah, I don't know enough about it to feel convinced one way or the other. I guess I would say like 176 is still quite a lot of the people who are on the ship.
Not to mention that if this is just on the top deck, you are limited in space. There's only so much space for these people.
And I mean, some of these people are traveling, you know, with their families. This is pretty late at night. You've got to think that some of these families are probably below decks. Maybe they've already put in for the night.
I'm very willing to accept that it's higher than 176.
Mm-hmm.
But I need to see some facts backing up 330 or 300.
I'm sure it is higher than 176, but I don't think that they're hiding like hundreds of deaths from the
right.
public.
Yeah, there's not a conspiracy afoot here, or is there?
We can say that 176 is kind of the bare minimum, which is on its own pretty bad.
Is there any chance that they had to take evasive action to avoid a NATO submarine in the river?
The most daring NATO submarine mission ever. We're going to hit the city of Samara from the Volga. So at the trial that came after this, the conductor of the train testified as a witness to the tragedy, and his words were recounted by Lyubov Beskromnaya, who was the wife of Valery that we talked to earlier.
The ship appeared so immense from above, as if it had been covered with a red tablecloth. There was so much blood from the dead.
That's horrifying.
Yeah, talk about like something you're going to see every night when you try to go to sleep for the rest of your life. Like, imagine that.
And what actually happens, I don't think I included these details, is that the ship, like we said, is traveling at full speed, and the top more or less just kind of shears clean off. So the ship continues through the bridge.
Yeah, like it doesn't stop.
Yeah, it continues forward, and it's sort of drifting. Obviously, I don't think it lost power. I think they maybe...
Not necessarily, but I'm sure that you're going to shut things down for a second.
And so it continues drifting forward, and it comes to rest here. But yeah, like it goes clean through here. Thinking about what that does to all of the people who are on top of this. The one longer article that I do want to dive into in a Patreon episode, it's called, the first part of the title is Mesorubka Strashneya, which is horrible meat grinder, which is a pretty good way to describe this.
That sounds like a metal album.
3 years after the accident, that couple, Valeri and Lyubov, they still were in the hospital.
That's wild.
The husband, Valeri, he underwent 64 surgical operations and he ended up losing both of his legs.
Can you imagine spending 3 years in a late Soviet hospital?
That's kind of the horrifying thing about this particular incident is we don't see a lot of incidents on this show where you have such horrifying physical trauma.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of the people who we talk about on this show, you know, obviously a lot of drowning. There's a lot of, you know, we have people die in fires and explosions and things like that. This one leaves a lot of people maimed for life, mm-hmm. you know, which is kind of a rare thing for stuff that we talk about. And the main question in this tragedy remains, why? Why did this happen? First Officer Yevgeny Matenkov and Helmsman Andrei Uvarov were both killed in the incident. We mentioned that the deckhouse, the bridge, was sheared off in this, so they were killed. Referring back to the thing where it said Matenkov was reading a book, I don't know how he would know that.
Mm-hmm.
There's no one around to talk about that.
Right.
That prevents any firsthand knowledge of what actually happened in the wheelhouse in those moments leading up to the collision. Quoting again from Yekaterina Nikolaeva from Tech Insider.
The investigation immediately put forward one version of the story. Uvarov and Matenkov were drunk. This was confirmed by the fact that on June 5th, 1983, Chef Nadezhda Chalaya organized a feast in honor of her birthday. However, an examination refuted this story. No alcohol was found in either man's system.
I like the sort of, I guess maybe window into the Russian/Soviet mind here, where they were drunk. We have proof. It was someone's birthday.
Yeah, of course they were drunk, right?
It was the part of the crew's birthday. Of course they were drunk. That kind of gets thrown out saying, well, we know that works for probably 99% of the accidents that happened in the Soviet Union, but not this one.
But we did test.
Another explanation put forward had to do with the amount of experience on the bridge that night. Mitenkov is quite experienced with this, but Uvarov is not. Because of that lack of experience, maybe he did not understand where he needed to direct the Suvarov.
Right.
In that case, that does become believable if we think that Mitenkov was distracted, not paying attention for some reason. Maybe he was reading a book.
I can't imagine being engrossed that much in that book.
That detail kind of reminds me of the Donya Pass with the mm-hmm. detail about how the captain was watching a Betamax tape in his cabin.
Yeah.
Why would anyone know that? So Oleg Shishkin writes that the crew of the Suvorov would have passed under the bridge at Ulyanovsk a minimum of 17 times before the night of the accident. I'm assuming he means like the crew as it was.
Yeah. Like that in night. That rotation or whatever. Yeah. It's just, there's so many other bridges too. Like just going under a bridge is just not a big deal.
And these things do have signs. At least one of the sources said that, yeah, there was a big orange sign that's labeled Vhod, like entrance. This is where you go. Although we will see in just a second here what the investigation really finds. Point being, Mitenkov, the first mate, would have most definitely known where to direct this ship. If he was paying attention, this wouldn't have been an issue. So I think there is probably circumstantial evidence that Mitenkov was distracted and not directing the vessel, maybe putting too much trust in the helmsman. The wreck was officially chalked up to four primary causes. Negligence on the part of the first mate, Mitenkov. Negligence on the part of the helmsman, Uvarov. Absence of signal lights on the bridge during hours of darkness. So this is one of the details that I don't know if there's definitive answer for. The best I can construct is that, yes, the that span, the correct span of the bridge, was signed and labeled, this is where you're supposed to go, it may not have been properly lit up for the nighttime. That could be part of the issue. There's another issue, though, and this kind of fits well with the issue of the helmsman's experience. So there's a, I believe they refer to it as like a lineman's shack cabin thing for the train. There's one of those on the bridge. And that has lights on it. It's possible that the helmsman, with his lack of experience, may have seen those lights and thought that was where he was supposed to take the ship. I don't know how big these lights were. I don't know what they looked like. I don't know if they looked anything like what these route signage lights would have looked like. But that at least, to me, the layman, makes sense that an inexperienced helmsman, maybe Mitenkov is very engrossed in his book and you don't want to bother him. And so you...
I guess that's part of what's hard, too, is like you don't know what the relationship between the crew members are like. You know, maybe this guy's just kind of an asshole. Like, who knows? You know, there's a lot. It sounds like poor bridge resource management.
We've seen enough of these to know that, like, yeah, communication, not asking enough questions is always a bad thing, especially when you're in the position of being less experienced. Captain Klemyonov, who survived, he did face trial, and he was given a 10-year sentence. And this sentence wasn't really for the wreck itself. He wasn't charged with, you know, negligence or anything like that. It was more for his behavior afterwards.
The investigation concluded that the captain had withdrawn himself from rescue attempts for the victims. No injuries were found on him. And because he could not establish order on the ship, the court sentenced him to 10 years imprisonment.
A sentence that I think could seem harsh, but I think also not probably alien to your more traditionalist conceptions of what the captain's job is.
Yeah, honestly, it is more than you see a lot of times in these stories for what appears to be maybe some negligence, even if it's not directly in that moment of not having crew trained properly.
You can definitely see where the captain would bear some responsibility for this, but he is charged more for his... You kind of get the sense of he's charged because he survived. At least by the court's judgment, didn't appear to put himself in too much danger to try to rescue people. I don't think everybody would agree that the captain deserved 10 years in prison, but I think it's at least something where it's understandable the logical steps taken to, well, someone has to be responsible for this. The people who are probably responsible are both dead. So,
and you were their boss. So,
and the captain's here. So the captain, yeah, I mean, we kind of expect the captain to face some sort of punishment for that. Klemyonov, he served only 6 of these years. I say only 6. 6 years in a Russian prison is probably not great.
That couldn't have been fun.
He served 6 of these before being freed on the basis of his declining health.
That was probably just to get people out of prison because they didn't want to keep paying for it.
That's also wrapped up. You know, this is when the Soviet Union is falling apart.
Yeah, I imagine everybody was getting out at that point.
He died of a heart attack in 1990, and apparently felt that guilt until his dying moments. He never really got over the fact that he had been at least partially responsible for this.
It sounds like he's the guy that has remorse, at least for these incidents, which is about all you can ask for, I think, sometimes.
And he had a long career. I mean, he was, I think, 26 years. I mean, he had spent literally half his life on ships sailing. So I mean, he was a guy who knew what he was doing. A sad ending for Captain Klemyonov. Before we get into the wrap-up portion, there's a few pieces I wanted to throw in that just didn't really fit anywhere else. And the main one, so at the time that this incident happens, 1983, we mentioned Yuri Andropov, and Yuri Andropov is only the leader of the Soviet Union for like 15 or like 18 months. Very few things happened during Andropov's time, and this is one of them. And so when this happened, kind of the highest person up in the Soviet chain of command who's kind of directly responsible for something like this, a major transportation accident, is a guy named Haydar Aliyev. He had been appointed by Andropov as first deputy chairman of the USSR's Council of Ministers in charge of transportation.
Mm-hmm.
Listeners might hear that surname, Aliyev, and maybe their ears perk up. Haydar Aliyev would go on to serve as the third president of Azerbaijan, and his son, Ilham Aliyev, is the current president of Azerbaijan.
Interesting.
So there's a weird connection to modern Caucasus politics here.
It's interesting how all the people that were in charge during the Soviet Union, somehow all their families are still in charge now.
Getting to some of the memorial type things. Like I said, there's not a huge amount of writing about this. At the time, this was definitely hushed up. This was not something that was widely written about. Very brief, very short news announcements that there had been an accident in Ulyanovsk, but very little information was disseminated about it. Through the decades, especially post-Soviet Union, more has been written about this. Archives have been opened up. People can find more information about this. And so there have been some memorials established to this. One was dedicated in 1999 in Ulyanovsk. And I was kind of confused by this article. Oleg Shishkin, who we've quoted from before in this episode, he covered what I think was a rededication ceremony for the same memorial.
Mm-hmm.
It might have been a different memorial. And I think this was in 2006. I didn't have great documentation on when or where this was.
Today in Ulyanovsk, a memorial was opened to the memory of those who perished in the wreck of the cruise liner Alexander Suvorov. On this memorial, there are no names, no surnames. There is twisted metal from a span of the bridge, under which hundreds of lives were cut short. An Orthodox cross, a ship's anchor, and a date, June 5th, 1983. The whole ceremony takes no more than half an hour. In place of solemn words, there are the lingering horns of ships on the Volga and a threefold military salute.
So as we come to the end of this episode, which is longer than I expected it to be, there is a kind of humorous story that I did want to share. I think it's good to share those with the horrors that come with most of these stories. We talked about that movie being shown in the theater. This is from that Yakov Lysenko article from Gazeta, and he writes about a couple that was traveling on the Suvorov.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe he gives them a name anywhere, which, I mean, make of that what you will, but it seems it's a plausible story. So that evening they were showing this movie, and you have this couple who are sitting together watching this film.
Mm-hmm.
And after it starts, the husband starts to get a little restless. He's bored with whatever movie this happens to actually be. And he whispers to his wife, "Hey, I'm going to go back to the cabin. I'm not really vibing with this movie. I'm just going to go hang out in the cabin." And so he gets up and he leaves. Almost immediately, the wife starts to get suspicious. And she thinks, "He's not going back to the cabin. He's going to go drink with his friends. You know, with, you know, neighboring cabins, whatever, people he met on the ship. He's going to go get drunk.
He's going to go get drunk."
Typical Russian husband. And so she goes down, you know, to the cabins. Maybe she knocks on like a neighbor's cabin. I don't know. But she does. They open the door. And sure enough, her husband is, you know, in there drinking with his buddies. And just as she's about to yell at him, that's when the collision happens.
So his alcoholism may have saved a life.
Yes. So just like, I mean, this is, we can put this into the hall of interesting with that guy from the Saint-Philibert who missed the return trip because he was buying cigarettes.
There's the guy from the Bedfordshire who got into like a bar fight.
Him
in,
too?
In Moorhead City and got arrested.
I doubt you could expand it into a book, but some sort of compilation of people saved by their vices.
I bet you could. You could probably do like 8 short stories or something.
I just thought that was a kind of a story where you do have something positive that they both end up surviving yes, on the other hand, you have other stories that don't work out so well. You do have couples where one of them is in the movie theater and one of them is not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of them is killed and the other one survives. But there's some positivity and silver linings to take from this that are worth sharing. So I do just want to finish with a quote here, wrapping things up. Quote from Shishkin again.
The cruise ship Alexander Suvorov still carries tourists. She has long since gotten a different captain and a different crew. And here, no one remembers the tragedy. Only, the ship no longer visits Ulyanovsk.